I think the abiding memory for me is being locked up in that castle buildings, which is not a great building to be locked up in, by the way, for several days as the thing lurched from crisis to crisis, and yet emerging at the end of it absolutely exhausted after barely any sleep over those days, with an historic agreement and stumbling out into the light, as it were, after all that negotiation and realizing something profound and historic had occurred. Because I mean, people often forget this, but you know, when we came to power in 1997, I mean, the ceasefire had broken down. There were terrorist actions still happening, and the thing looked frankly pretty hopeless. And even when we did the Good Friday Agreement, at that point, Ian Paisley, obviously, and his party were outside the building protesting against it.
And how aware were you of the spectre of Paisley outside?
Very aware, because obviously for David Trimble negotiating it, he was having to have one eye at least looking over his shoulder. So we were very well aware of it. But it was a very interesting dynamic in the process, because what happened in a way was that, you know, when we first got there, all the preparations that we thought had been in place really turned out not to be. And there really wasn't any agreement at all. And I remember some people saying to me as we began that week, look, this is hopeless. But then as the days went on, one thing that was interesting, because there was so much speculation and focus, and there was a whole bank of media covering it sort of almost 24 hours a day, you know, as that happened, then also what happened is that the sort of stakes, as it were, got higher, and the desire to reach an agreement got more intense.
And what tactics were you employing? Was it a mixture of tactics? Did you get angry at times?
Not so much angry as, deeply frustrated, because what would happen, it was a bit like a sort of seesaw. So every time you sort of balanced it out one side, it threatened to go too far, and you had to sit on the other side and try and pull it back a bit. And so, you know, this was a very, very delicate set of negotiations. And, you know, spending so much time as I do now out in the Middle East with the role I've got there, I mean, it was a very interesting example that we stumbled upon almost by accident, of where you do at certain points need just intense focus and determination to pull something through, because there are so many things that can go wrong and frequently do.
And there must have been a point where you thought to yourself, that's it, this has fallen apart.
Well, you know, I never gave up hoping, actually. There was a point just towards the end of the third day when we thought we had an agreement and then it sort of crumbled in our hands, when I must say some people around me at least thought, that's it, it's just not going to happen.
What did they say to you?
I can repeat the language quite, but I mean, basically, you know, all this work and it's going to come to nothing. But I had an instinct that out there amongst people, and not just people in Northern Ireland, but in the whole of the UK, there was a genuine desire to try and, you know, create a new future from what had been a very troubled history. And you know, the leaders that were there, from the Ulster Unionists and David Trimble, from Sinn Féin, from the SDLP side, and the various other different groupings like the Alliance and so on, there was a collective. The fact they all kept there was an indication they wanted to do it if they could.
You mentioned the leaders. Let's talk about Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness. So you're sitting face to face with Sinn Féin's negotiators. Now, in your mind, Tony, are you negotiating with the IRA when you're looking into their eyes?
Well, you're negotiating with the Republican movement. Let's put it like that. I mean, let me use reasonably diplomatic language. But I mean, there was never any doubt in my mind that, and this was one very important aspect, actually, of the whole agreement, that if they agreed, then you had everybody, including the IRA, on board.
I've often wondered why it was so important to you personally. You'd never lived in Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland it should have been a bit part in importance to you. Why wasn't it? Why was it so important?
It was a small part personal, actually, because my mother had been brought up, actually, in south of Ireland, but I'd always remember, because I used to go there every summer for my holidays, and I remember just when the Troubles began. In the early 70s, we then stopped, and we used to correspond as a family with certain of the people there, and you could just see the sectarianism and the hatred growing. So there was a sort of personal thing, but it was also because I felt for the UK, I mean, we were introducing devolution, we were trying to, as it were, modernize the country, and here you had this dispute in one part of the UK, which really disfigured the development of the whole of Northern Ireland, and where you kind of felt, look, as we approach the 21st century, surely we must be able to find a better way of doing it. So, you know, it did matter to me, partly for personal reasons, but also partly because I thought we're about to engage in a new millennium. This dispute has its place in history. It doesn't have a place in the future.
Do you have any regrets from how you handled the process? For example, do you sympathise with the SLP, the Ulster Unionists, who would eventually feel cast aside?
Yes, I do, actually. And, you know, I understand some of their criticisms of what we did. And the risk in always in these situations, but it's a very hard risk to avoid, is that because those at the furthest end of this political spectrum have to be on board as well. If you're not careful, you spend a lot of time trying to bring them on board, and the people who are on board already, and by the way, have often taken massive political risks to be so, obviously feel a bit, not just discomforted, but rejected. And on the other hand, the trouble is, you know, you've got to have the whole spectrum there in order to make the thing work.
So what specifically is your regret? For example, do you think you personally let David Trimble down?
I hope not, and I don't think so. I think in the end that there was also, and this is part of the inevitable dynamic of a situation like this, there was some feeling, I think, within both communities, both the unionist and the nationalist stroke Republican community, that in the first stages of this, in any event, you wanted the ones that were going to be toughest just to make sure there weren't any wrong concessions wrung out of you. You know, so I think that dynamic is quite hard to displace. Now, maybe at points when I look back at it, I think particularly with the SDLP as well, I mean, I understand their anxiety, but the trouble is they weren't really wanting to go ahead without the Republicans. And therefore, there wasn't really an option for me to say, okay, we're now going to go ahead without Sinn Féin. And likewise, on the unionist side, in the end, you know, I hope, and I certainly should have paid great tribute to David Trimble and his leadership, but ultimately the unionist community decide who they vote for.
What did it feel like to get the agreement?
It was a moment of great exhilaration, actually, and there are very few moments like that in politics. And I remember going, you know, because I was actually by then 2 to 3 days late for a meeting I had in Spain with the Spanish Prime Minister. So I literally went from Castle Buildings and got on a plane. And as I sat down in my seat on the plane, the Queen called me just to you know, be very gracious and give congratulations and so on. And I think it's at that moment it suddenly dawned on me, you know, gosh, this really is a huge historic event.
And did you foresee the torturous events that lay ahead?
Not entirely. But I think that's also a lesson too. I think when I look back on it, I think, no, you can't be surprised. Because what the peace agreement does, and it would be the same, by the way, if we got one in the Middle East, is it sets a framework, but it doesn't, the peace doesn't come at that moment. The peace comes with the implementation. And, you know, so the date for me that is most significant was when in 2007, effectively, as it's just before I stepped down from office, you know, Martin McGuinness and Ian Paisley were sitting there and they were going to be in office together.
You talk about frameworks, and one of the big issues that people are now talking about in Northern Ireland is what do we do? What type of framework do we put around victims so that they do not feel left behind? For example, do you think there should be a South African-style truth commission? Have you any idea what would work for victims in Northern Ireland?
I'm kind of reluctant to go back into the policy issues that I think the present government and the politicians have really got a handle now. I mean, I don't want to comment on specifics, but I mean, I think it is important that we
a huge issue, though, isn't it? Victims.
It is a huge issue because the pain of those people, and some of the most difficult meetings I ever did when I was Prime Minister is when I met the victims of the Troubles, and you know their stories were harrowing and frankly, you know, tragic. In the terms of general principle, I think it's absolutely right and necessary to remember their sacrifice and remember that their pain remains, even if the agreement has changed the politics.
Just finally, obviously I'm talking to you today after the death of Baroness Thatcher. How should people remember Lady Thatcher?
Well, you know, as I've been saying to people, of course she was a controversial figure, and there are some people who still will regard her with dislike and hatred even. But I think if you take a more objective and broad historical perspective, you've got to say she was a huge political figure and changed not just her country, but the way people look at the world. So, it's I think we as a country, I think, can and should look back on her with a sense of national pride, even though there are areas, for example, Europe, where I would disagree with her strongly, and some of her social policies I would disagree with strongly. I'm from the other side of politics, but I think if you're trying to be fair about it, you've got to say, you know, this was a highly significant leader.
The street celebrations that are going on about her death, people gloating about her death. What would you say about those celebrations?
I think they're just that's pretty poor taste, really. I mean, you've got to. I think you've got to. Even if you disagree with someone very strongly, by the way, I mean, you can still, particularly at the moment of their passing, you should show some respect, I think.
Do you worry it would happen to you because of Iraq? Has it crossed your mind?
Not really, and I hope it's no time soon. But I think it's just it's part of modern political life. I mean, if you were a leader for three terms as she was and I was, you know, you take decisions, you take them that are very difficult, and you take them in circumstances where you're the leader there at the time and have to take them. And I'm afraid, you know, when you decide, you divide, and that's just the way of it. So I think she would be pretty philosophical about it, and I hope I will be too.
The Prime Minister's just finally, Mr. Blair, do they worry about their legacies? Do you worry about yours?
I can't answer for everyone. I mean, I don't in the sense of sort of day to day, because I think, you know, in the end, things change. I mean, I said to someone the other day, you should remember that in 2001, we fought an election campaign where one of our posters, half sort of tug-in-cheek and humorously, was William Hague, who was the then Conservative leader, metamorphosing into Margaret Thatcher. And in 2001, you know, that was still a downside for the Conservatives in an election. You know, frankly, we wouldn't have been fighting the 2010 election in the same way. You know what I mean? So times change and the mood of people changes. And so I think the sensible thing as a political leader, particularly when you've been there for any length of time, is to worry about what you're still doing and what you can still contribute. And I do a lot of things in which I'm passionately engaged in the world and really let the legacy look after itself, because ultimately it's not us who will judge it.
And final question, Mr. Blair, and thank you for your time today. Let's come back to Northern Ireland. As you look into Northern Ireland now, what do you think of our wee country, as we would say?
Well, I think the progress has been immense. And I think there should be an enormous sense of pride amongst the people in Northern Ireland. And by the way, you know, around the world, and I see a lot of the world now, because most of the work I do, whether it's in Middle East or Africa or elsewhere, I'm seeing how the world views things. Northern Ireland, its peace process, the Good Friday Agreement, is seen as one of the huge landmarks of peaceful negotiation to conflict. So I hope people have a sense of pride, and I hope that leads them to always be vigilant that any fragilities are removed and the peace process is kept stable and solid.
Some people think we could slip back.
Well, I hope not. And we should just remember what it was like, and maybe that's the best way of ensuring we don't go back to it.
Mr. Blair, thank you very much for your time today, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.